I am incredibly excited about this new series we're in called The Adventures in Saying Yes. We'll be exploring what that could look like in the next couple of weeks as well. We'll be taking a look at what yes to justice might look like, what yes to a better way of conflict might look like. And it's been fun for me even over the last couple of weeks to consider my own heart with this idea of yes. What is my inclination and how does that pour out into the world around me? Last year, about this time, we ran a similar series called The Art of Neighboring. It was one of those series like this one, I think, that sort of hits at the DNA of who we think ourselves to be. Loving, in the case of last year, we took some time to explore God's greatest commandment to yes, love himself, but to also yes, love our neighbors as ourselves. And we tried to move that into our actual neighborhoods and communities and see what that would look like. For me, I realized, like, wow, despite it feeling like central to the core of who I might think myself to be, it was actually hard to do. I felt like, oh, I'm kind of a white belt in neighboring well. I shared a story last year of this relationship that we have with our neighbor right next to us, where I backed up over his little wire fence at the end of our driveway intentionally, and then I put the car in drive and drove over it again immediately, intentionally. So that was a picture of my fine neighboring moment, and this was the image I showed of the fence to sort of symbolize this quirkiness and divisiveness in our neighboring relationship. This year, though, the fence looks like this. Yeah, more crushed and many, many pieces into the ground. However, this is actually a sign of progress. It does appear to have been run over many more times, but not intentionally by me. And my neighbor hasn't put up a new one. So I feel like that's progress. You know, it doesn't feel like we need to have a super definable dividing symbol anymore. Anyway, it got me thinking that this inclination to love and to be present to the people around us is a hard one. And maybe last year we could have considered taking a step even sooner than where we had started. That instead of thinking about how to interact with these intimate relationships that we have in close quarters to build those up, that maybe it would have been helpful to consider the many more people we brush up against all of the time in all of our spaces, to consider the stranger. And that perhaps this idea of saying yes to the strangers around us could somehow feel like a helpful prerequisite to loving our neighbor, to give us a chance for our hearts to warm up. So today, I'd love to invite you just into that space where you could entertain the idea that saying yes to a stranger might have some really great implications, and not just for the stranger we can identify, but for ourselves too. I think we're all called to sort of this interconnectedness by a big, adventurous Jesus who wants us to figure that out. So there are people, it turns out, that spend a lot of their professional lives studying how we interact with one another, particularly in our public spaces, these sidewalks, our cafes, our grocery stores. And they've come up with this phrase, civil inattention. In most parts of the U.S., they say, we try to maintain a balance of civility and privacy. It's the norm that strangers don't talk to each other, right? And they give this example over and over again, sociologists do. Maybe you've experienced this before, where you're walking down the street, and at about 8 to 10 feet away, you're willing to look up and acknowledge that we see the other person by eye contact. That's sort of the civil behavior in our interaction. But then we avert our gaze to communicate our lack of recognition of the other and our unwillingness to become more familiar. Basically, I think it's this understood message that we like to ignore each other. And we kind of prefer that to some degree, to pretend that the other doesn't exist, sort of keeping that unknown face at an arm's length. Parker Palmer, this author and Quaker, and many more things, wrote a book to this to this beat, essentially, thinking about our strangers and our public spaces. And he says, oh, we need to move beyond that baseline of interaction, that civil inattention, to actually have a full life. If we don't, our lives and our public life will suffer greatly. He says that public life is vital to our human experience. Yes, our private lives are important, but we need the other half, this public life, to really make our lives feel whole. It seems like God would back this up as well, right? He calls us into relationship. He's made us to be these relational beings, and not just with our family and friends, but with those who we might categorize as different or strange. I think if I'm getting some of his messages, he says, we're all in this together. Human unity that we hope for has little chance if we don't engage in our public realm. I like to think that I do a good job of engaging in this public sphere, hopefully communicating some warmth to people around me. And then it came sort of crashing down recently when my phone broke for 5 days. My phone broke for 5 days. I tried to play it off initially of like, oh, this is so freeing. I'm fine. Like, I'm not attached to my device. And then internally, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is terrifying. I spend a lot of time meeting with people throughout the week, and I hadn't checked directions, you know, before I left the office. And I went to meet somebody and realized like, oh, I don't actually know where this place is. And so I got into Harvard Square and realized, oh my goodness, I'm gonna have to say words to a stranger to find out where this place is. And it was so challenging me to figure out, like, how do I violate this unspoken code of do not interrupt, like, do not come close to me. And it was also striking that I seemed to gravitate towards people that were in some way familiar to me. That I was looking hard for a safe person and sort of constructing that in my mind. I seem to miss the obvious value of our shared existence, that it's not achieved with those we already know, right? It's to look for those, interact with ones we don't. And when we talk about the word stranger, I think it's tough to generate warmth, right? That word in and of itself is a tough word. It carries with it so many implicit messages. Don't talk to strangers, right, is a message we probably heard at some point in our early years. And that comes with so many subtle yet significant messages that I think actually have taken up some residence in our society and in the way we interact. There's something in that person to be afraid of. Interacting is too risky. Safety is seen by distance. And I think we might talk about our unwillingness to interact with strangers as sort of this prudent posture of safety. And I sort of just want to make a pause here and say that I don't want to communicate that we should willingly put ourselves in harm's way. Or for those of you who have had tough experiences sort of with strangers or in this public spheres, I'm not sort of pushing that. And I want to give you freedom in that to realize like, oh yeah, some people's best intentions for us are not what they're carrying. But I think if we were to look at it more squarely, our posture to refrain from strangers isn't as much about prudence, but might be more about fear. Ironically, I felt this even in the small town in Maine that I grew up in. I remember my parents saying, don't talk to strangers, you know? And I found it even curious then because I was like, we don't even have any strangers. I don't even know what that looks like. And it was really true. Like, we just didn't bump up against many new people. But it was always this message of, but you might. There's a possibility that someone different might come in and disrupt. And that was what was to be feared, the possibility of that. Fear, I think, is a driving force that affects our posture in the public realm for a lot of different reasons. Yes, our physical well-being. Yes, our emotional well-being. But I think what we fear most is the unpredictable. And perhaps that's why we can give so much power to this baseline of interaction of civil inattention. We don't like unpredictable variables in our days. It's scary, it's unmooring, and it's exhausting. And so to cultivate environments that minimize risk and enhance our sense of certainty, I think, is where we spend most of our energy, rather than interacting and building relationships. And it's curious to me that we spend so much time doing that, because there's no certainty to our safety, right? Especially if we're talking about these public realms. Safety is an illusion that we try to craft into reality. And I think we do a great job at convincing ourselves that we do. And we measure it by our own levels of comfort, right? If I'm comfortable, then I'm safe. Yes, it seems that in our quests for safety, we actually move, though, toward more discomfort. We sort of detach from the places around us, move to more isolated spaces, and in that, I think we lose a sense of belonging to the people and the spaces around us. So when we feel uncomfortable, we compensate, right? I notice that I do this. I might be in an airport or choosing a seat on an airplane, and I immediately put my earbuds in. It's like communicating immediately, do not talk to me. So it might be that, or maybe you look at your phones, but we try to create our own little microcosms of private life in our public spheres. That's our external way of trying to uphold this illusion of safety, right? And internally, I think we do this too. We try really hard to shift our feelings of fear and uncertainty away from us. That makes us feel uncomfortable. So we give legs to our fear by depositing into something we can find to look more certain. Now, I don't think I necessarily assign or attach all this fear on one particular person, but I'll use a category or a type of person that I should be fearful of and hang all of it on that. This is why the category of stranger, I think, works so well. It's a depository box, really, for anything that makes me feel uncomfortable. I can put a whole bunch of people into it, and it makes my public spheres feel more doable. Because it's easier to ignore or dismiss or overlook a category than a person. And I think that's what we might do sometimes, even unconsciously, is take away the face of a person because we're uncomfortable with the unknown. And in that effort, we set up a clear gridwork of what we're saying yes to, and by default, what we're saying no to. Yes to safety, yes to overlooking, yes to comfort. And all we need to say no to is a stranger. How costly could that be, right? I think Jesus jumps in to say, well, I can give you a picture of the cost. Look at me. The cost is the ever-stretching picture of me found in the stranger. And if you're looking for newness and life and perspective from me, you'll miss some of the fullness of it without this person in your midst. And I realized recently that in the same way I seek a sense of safety in my public spaces, I do the same with God. And perhaps the two are a little more intricately tied together than I'd thought. I think God is very big. He's full of mystery and wonder and so many pieces of things that I don't understand and will never grasp. And yet I like to manage him. I like to know where he'll show up. I look for him in my comfortable spaces. This space, this morning, with all of you. Jesus is known to be here. On my commutes in the morning, I expect to have an interaction with Jesus in my community group. When I go to bed at night, at the end of a long day, and all of those variables that are unpredictable are quiet. When my environments are controlled and still, there's Jesus. But I think Jesus continues to nudge me and say, that version of me is costly because I'm not controllable and I'm not still. This living Jesus that we hope to connect with stands up in front of me every day in tens of hundreds of ways as a dynamic, fluid, moving being found in each stranger's face that I pass by. To follow Jesus is an adventure into the unknown, and it hinges on me seeing the stranger. So let's see if we can go a little deeper here. Join me if you're up for it in the scripture on the program. I think it gives us some rich texture about the value of our relationship to this stranger. So this is the swath of scripture where we get this story of the two followers on the road to Emmaus, shortly after Jesus has been crucified, but it's already in the environment of hearing, like, oh, and he could have arose. So here we go. Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but they did not see him. Then he said to them, 'Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all these scriptures." As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it's almost evening and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. When their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight, they said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" That same hour, they got up and returned to Jerusalem. So perhaps you can identify with these two followers of Jesus. They're sad, they're puzzled, they're wrestling with injustice that they've just witnessed, an innocent man, a friend of theirs, put to death, and they've lost what they thought was a picture of hope for the world around them. And they're left staring at a public society and a political setting that is littered with fear, danger, and unpredictability. And so they're headed out of Jerusalem to their home village, Emmaus. As they're walking along, I can imagine what some of their conversation might have been like. Super intense, right? To try to make sense of all that had just happened. What was it that's happened? What does this mean? There are rumors that he's risen again, and it seems true, right? They've seen the tomb where he would be if he were dead. But he's not there. And he's not next to them as they've known him to be in his aliveness. If you're alive, where are you? How do we know to find you? And then they get their answer, right? Jesus appears on this public road as a stranger. And it's interesting, right? I always wonder when I read this, like, why didn't he just appear to them in Emmaus when they had arrived there? And why didn't he appear to them as himself in a form that they would recognize him in? I think Jesus does this because he's trying to communicate something about himself that he wants the followers to understand and see anew, and that it's going to take a little disruption to communicate that to them. So reading this passage, I can see a couple of things. I can see, even before the followers realize, right, that it's Jesus next to them. He's come back. He's alive. And with that, he's bringing all the things that he's talked about, all these promises, newness and hope and life for humanity. And I can see that these followers, although they're sad, are still looking for that. This very same things, the newness and hope and life. If they had met Jesus as himself in Emmaus, it would have been a match, right? It would have fit so nicely. They would have clearly recognized him. He would have communicated what he wanted to bring. They would have said, yes, that's what we've been looking for. And that would have been it. But Jesus shifts that a little bit, right? He shows up as a stranger to intentionally interrupt, not just their conversation, but disrupt and shake up what they've known of Jesus up to this point. And I think by extension, what they're to think of the world around them. You see, the 7-mile road of Jerusalem to Emmaus sort of speaks to me of a spectrum of our own pictures of faith at any given point in time. Jerusalem sort of represents, at least to these followers, a picture of chaos, uncertainty, fear, and absence of Jesus. And Emmaus, on the other end of the spectrum, is familiar. It's their home village. It's known. There's safety there. And perhaps, if anywhere, that's where they would find Jesus. But I think Jesus wants to communicate and to have us have more than that. He wants to shift what we know of him beyond that container of safety. He wants us to see that interaction with the stranger is an expansive road that, in fact, is the linchpin to more growth with him, to really knowing him. A few months ago, I held these open cafe hours in the Panera down in Porter Square. I thought at the kind of crux of what I was hoping for, I guess, was that people from this community would come, have coffee, connect, we could talk about Jesus, and that would be great. And for a few weeks, it was. Many of you came. It was great. And then somewhere in the middle there, something different happened. I had walked in, I chose a table, and then immediately a stranger came over and asked if he could sit there. And I remember that moment so clearly because it was unexpected, and from my point of view, it was unwanted. It was such an inconvenience. I was like, ah, you're messing with my plan to interact with Jesus today. Right? I was expecting the space to be safe and comfortable, to have familiar people with similar thoughts about Jesus come in, to have a cinnamon bun maybe, but to be able to move on with my day and have all these great things checked off, right? Jesus, friends, we're good. But I think Jesus is showing me in this passage that if our posture is to hunker down in the familiar, we aren't really in a relationship with a living Jesus. We're missing these in-between spaces where we walk. The whole 7 miles of the Emmaus Road, where strangers show up as Jesus and intercept our trajectory in our day for the better. And I think he shows up as a stranger because he wants to show us that to fully live in these in-between spaces, we'll need to make a shift from our sights of safe spaces to that maybe of brave spaces. I believe that Jesus cares deeply for each and every one of us, and I don't think he delights in making things tricky for us, to disguise himself for us to play a spiritual game of hide and seek. I think he's actually instead trying to give us abundant opportunities to meet him in our in-between spaces. He's saying, here's 20 people on a bus with you. Or here's another 10 at the grocery store with you. Here's another 5, another 15. All of these people around you are ways to get to interact with me. And I think we're all walking this Emmaus Road, right? Not just us here in this room, but all of us, all of our humanity, seeking hope, a sense of belonging and meaning in our lives. And Jesus is inviting us to find that through the very thing we tend to steer clear of, each other. And I think it's going to take a little shift to see how it is we can interact with people around us. A little bravery in there. And bravery maybe isn't something we can study or learn, but it's something that comes from practice to actually try that out in mutual interactions with people And I think that practice helps release our grip on this value of safety. It was sobering for me recently to read a piece written by a woman by the name of Jennifer Bailey. She's a Black reverend in the AME Church. And she was reflecting sort of on her own road to Emmaus moment. She was recounting sort of her reaction to recent current events, and she was feeling, as she was talking to her husband, she sort of coined it as, "I feel unsafe. I feel unsafe." And as she was saying that to her husband in the kitchen that evening, she said she felt like a rush, a wind of voices of her ancestors coming in and saying, "Oh, baby, we've never been safe." And it was an additional layer for me to consider, to realize that so many people around us walk in brave spaces all the time, that this notion of safety, even if it's an illusion, is a privilege for me to entertain this posture. And so that tipped me into realizing, oh, I herald this safety so much, and yet so many other people walk with this bravery every day. So what does it look like then to sit in a Panera with a stranger who himself looks to be homeless, with layers and layers of clothes on and more bags than I can count? What does that scene look like without the definitive container of safety that I had wanted to craft? Jesus, I think, if he was to speak in that moment, would say, "You got what you wanted, right? You were trying to craft this space for human connection, for me in the midst of it. That's what it is. That's what you got." Except he's saying, "I just expanded it a little. I shifted it a little with this interruption of this stranger." And I think Jesus does the same thing with his followers. He doesn't necessarily take away any of the things that they know, right? He just redefines and brings newness to it. And sometimes I think we get stuck on that because the newness looks strange. But he brings them right back to the scripture that they know, right? The words of Moses and the prophets that foretold Jesus' own life and death and resurrection. But he opens them up with this new perspective. He shows them the scriptures with a fresh lens, words they had already read before. That the living Jesus wasn't described by the words of safety or familiar or predictable, but instead enveloped by this word faith, which sort of demands a little bit of adventure and bravery. A tiny shift. And he took them to what they understood so deeply of human connection, and he says, "Yes, yes, that is important. You know that to be. Except let me shift your direction a little bit. Instead of going to find that human connection in the familiar, in this hometown of yours, how about you head back to Jerusalem, this brave space for you? Look for me in that town where you thought me to be dead, and find me in the living, in the face of everyone you pass." And he also shifts for them, I think, things that they had landed on, that they had sort of settled in and thought were over and done with. They had hoped, it said, for a Messiah who would come to rescue Israel. But they felt like that was dashed, that hope was dashed. He was crucified. How could that happen? But the stranger comes in to shift their perspective, to show them with a new lens, Jesus' crucifixion as the way that Israel would be redeemed. It's this little shift. They're looking at the same thing, but with a new lens. They had known Jesus for 3 years in human form, and so Jesus appears as that, in human form, right? He doesn't come as an angel or a dove, except he shifts it a little bit. He appears as unrecognizable to them. Perhaps to shrink this tendency that we all have to separate where we find Jesus. He wants to shift for us to see our public spaces as spiritual places. He knows that we'll seek him to feel alive, but he also knows we won't seek the stranger. Jesus encourages us, no more separation. Think of me and the stranger as one and the same. So the stranger opens up all the many things we know with fresh perspective and is our compass, I think, right back to Jesus, to the fullness of who he is at any point in our day. It seems our only qualification is that we need to be interruptible. The simplicity of the yes that the followers give the stranger is found in two short words right in the scripture. It says, they stood still. In another interpretation, it says, stopped short. That's the yes, to pause, to be interrupted. It's this internal and physical willingness, really, I think, to stop our own direction in our day and entertain that this interruption is valuable and might hold more, even if it's something we don't yet know or understand. And I think this is the challenge maybe for all of us, to up our game beyond that notion of civil inattention, that way of interacting. The stranger sitting at the table across from me at Panera, yes, disrupted a lot. But it seems we need to be shaken up a little bit for perspective and to break down our assumptions. And if we can see it as such, it seems that this inconvenience is actually an open invitation to interact with the living, roaming Jesus that I think has a field day beyond these walls and maybe is the best shortcut to Jesus. The Franciscan priest Richard Rohr says, we do not think ourselves into new ways of living. We live ourselves into new ways of thinking. This seems to be what the whole Emmaus passage speaks to me of, this dynamic and maybe the order of our thinking and our living in ways that we'll always have to try to navigate. But I think Jesus is always there with this stranger to say, I can help your direction and help you reorder. Because I don't want you to forget the living part. So where do we begin? How do we say yes to a stranger? These are points that will be on your program if you're interested in filling in. So these points are sort of outlined first as a consideration. Like you can just consider this internally and see how it jives with you. And then there's a second point that's a try if you're warm to it. So the first, consider hospitality of the heart. This is a Parker Palmer phrase. It's a posture really to say yes to the stranger by using care when we speak of the stranger in our private spaces. That a private language of compassion and understanding can actually lead to a public life where we can see the stranger with integrity and dignity. If that feels warm to you, you could try sharing a recent experience of the prompt that we did in our extended meet your neighbor moment. If you meet a stranger this week, tell somebody about it. And use those words of compassion and understanding as you do. Secondly, ask Jesus to help you consider your spaces as brave spaces versus safe spaces. That bravery is going to take some interruption and a pause and a slowing in our day. It may make us feel awkward and inconvenienced, and ask us to have a layer of humility. And it might be more challenging than we expect. So I think it's worth asking Jesus to help us frame that. If you're willing, here's some tries. The first is grab a pocket square in the dome. So there's actual physical pieces of paper that are 2x2 that you could stick into your pocket. The hope is that at a baseline, maybe you would put it in your pocket throughout the week, touch it, and just sort of have it be a reminder of your interacting in public spaces. Maybe it will prompt your heart or your awareness of people around you. And maybe if you interact with a stranger and are feeling brave enough, you would extend this pocket square to them. On the flip side, it says pass it on, and so the hope is maybe it would travel a little ways if that stranger that you encounter also is inclined. There's also some postcards out there. We realize that stranger can be defined far beyond just public spaces, right? There's probably people in our lives that we've lost contact with, we'd like to reconnect with. Here's some postcards. Reach out to somebody that comes to mind. There's also a calendar and some signups for these yes dinners that we're hoping will provide a more structured way to meet some strangers in this community. So you can grab a seat. There's like 7 dinners lined up for the month of May. You can sign up, hop in, grab a seat for one of those dinners, and hopefully meet somebody at one of those dinners that you haven't yet come across here. Third, consider the stranger as a beautiful interruption. In most cases, my fleeting moments of interacting with strangers have been something beautiful. If we think of Jesus as the stranger, it's kind of mind-blowing, right? To be like, I am present right now in my actual space in my day, and here is Jesus. I think if we can pause and think of that, it's a beautiful interruption. Try breaking pattern for 5 minutes out of your day. When we can break pattern, I think we actually break new ground. And so try that out. See what happens. I'll leave whatever the pattern and the breaking is to you, but try it out. Lastly, enjoy the heartburn. The outcome of all this saying yes to a stranger business is curious. It's for sure not neatly packaged. In most encounters with strangers, we likely don't get much feedback. We don't know the outcome or the impact. My only interaction with eye contact with this man in Panera was when I asked his name. And he looked up, kind of with a startle, to be like, wow, she's asking me a question. And he answered, my name is Paul. And that was our only interaction. But it's something that's left a bit of a burn in my heart to remember that moment. In a way, I think, allowed me to have a little more warmness for the next stranger interaction. In the scriptures, the followers say, were not our hearts burning as he opened the scriptures to us. Something, it seems, is impactful to our hearts. It's a mix of something really good, puzzling, awkward. Whatever the mix is, it has the propensity, I think, to turn something on in our hearts that is laid dormant or just never been ignited. And the promise is in that is to, I think, feel something we've never felt before. So try this prayer as a way to get there. May the image of God in me meet the image of God in you. This is a practice that Christina Cleveland, a Duke University professor, uses in her classroom to help her like students that she doesn't like. And she says that throughout the course of a semester, it makes a difference. It softens her heart and seems to engage the students around her. And I think it's a powerful prayer. God, I can't actually recognize you in this other person. And so may you do that work. And this burn in our heart, I think, is the fuel that gives us enough energy to go running into our brave spaces every day, as the followers did back to Jerusalem, shouting, Jesus is alive, and you're never going to believe where I found him. So let me pray for all of us in that vein. Jesus, thank you for being here, for that buzz at the beginning of service, and for your continued work. In the ways that our hearts burning could be true, I feel like, oh, may that be intensified even over the rest of this time here together. God, help us to orient around what a brave space could even look like. Give us what we need for that. Resource us for that supernaturally. And God, just bring more of your goodness and your love and your care for us this morning. In your name, amen.